Welcome to episode 34 of Commonplace, Conversations with Poets and Other People. I'm Rachel Zucker. I spoke with poet, performer, scholar, Dr. Joshua Bennett at my apartment in New York City on June 20th, 2017. I had the great pleasure of meeting Joshua at the Sarah Lawrence Poetry Festival back in April. Joshua read with poet Araceli Skirmai, and it was one of the best readings I've ever attended in my life. After the reading, I invited Joshua and Araceli to talk with me for Commonplace. The episode with Araceli is coming up soon. Joshua Bennett is the author of the poetry collection The Sobbing School. He is a graduate of Penn, earned his doctorate at Princeton, and was a fellow at Harvard. Joshua is an amazing and accomplished spoken word artist. At our website, commonpodcast.com, you can find links to Joshua's performances, including his reading at the Obama White House, at the high school he attended, and at some of the Strivers Row events. There are links to the books and people and organizations that Joshua mentions in this episode, including, importantly, a link to the June Jordan Fellowship at Columbia's Center for Justice, and information about how to donate to the fellowship. Joshua and I talk about the June Jordan Fellowship, his role in it, and its important mission. I hope you'll consider supporting this essential project. Commonplace patrons will be entered in our next raffle, which includes copies of Joshua's book, The Sobbing School, courtesy of Penguin Books, and some of the other great books that are important to Joshua, including The Critique of Black Reason by Achille Mbembe. Many thanks to Duke University Press for providing this title. Patrons will get a sound file of Joshua reading his poem Ode to Pedagogy, and another sound file of Joshua reading new work. Please consider becoming a patron of Commonplace by going to patreon.com/commonplacepodcast or finding our Patreon link on commonpodcast.com. It would also be incredibly helpful if you could write us a review on iTunes and recommend the podcast to your friends, students, anyone who might be interested in great conversations with amazing artists. It was a delight and honor speaking with Joshua Bennett, and after our conversation, I have a long list of books that I'm excited to read or reread. I'm also incredibly excited for the publication of Joshua's next books of poetry and for the publication of his dissertation, Being Property Once Myself, in Pursuit of the Animal in 20th Century African American Literature. I'm eager to read and follow all the things Joshua writes and works on next. I am sure that he will continue to infiltrate, subvert, and improve existing institutions and create new spaces for learning and gathering, all while writing and performing kick-ass poems. I hope you enjoy this conversation with the amazing Joshua Bennett. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And I, we don't really know each other. And so I kind of wanted to like get to know each other a little bit in front of our future audience, which is a weird thing to do and not something I've really done before in the podcast. But I kind of wanted to, I don't know, in a way, like honor the fact that we're getting to know each other in this very sort of artificial way, instead of as it's been with some people, like, oh, I know you really well. How do I make sure that the people listening, you know, that we don't fall into a shorthand or something? Okay. Anyway, so that's why I was like ushering my husband out of the room who wants to ask you all the questions that I was about to ask you. But okay. So totally gonna just start with Jason.
Yeah. Jason Krieger. Yeah, the guy.
Okay, so we have this friend in common, and Jason teaches at the school where all three of my kids go. My oldest son just graduated a few weeks ago, and my husband is an English teacher there. And I asked Jason, because I just saw him within the hour, wait, how do you know Joshua Bennett? And he said, well, we met in graduate school. But then Jason said, as he was leaving the room, yeah, because Joshua was at Princeton and I was at Yale. And I was like, okay, then I don't understand. Still don't.
Those places aren't
make
close
sense.
Together. Right, right.
So wait, how did you meet Jason?
Yeah. Oh, well, first, I just want to thank you for having me on the show and welcoming me into your home. I feel like I don't know, it's a beautiful thing, and it's a loving and caring thing to have folks over.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do I know Jason? All right, so I met Jason through my high school best friend, Rodney. We were all at a panel together called, rather ominously, Is the Black Church Dead? And this was a panel that happened at Union Theological Seminary, which isn't too far from here. It's in Harlem. And I just thought he was hilarious and brilliant. And he was part of this really kind of amazing cohort of folks that were at Yale Divinity School at the same time. So it was him, Rodney, one of my best friends now, a fellow by the name of Jamal Calloway. He'll be at Brown next year on a postdoc. Our friend Kyle, who's getting his PhD at Vanderbilt. So pretty much all of us became like academics and administrators and teachers out of that friend group in graduate school. But that's how we met a while ago. And we just sort of stuck to each other after that panel. We just kept hanging out. I would go to New Haven to sort of visit everyone, and we all would spend time in the city. And it was quite incredible. I mean, those were formative years for me. And I really can't imagine surviving graduate school without Jason and without that group. I think Princeton was a very lonely place in many ways, and having those kinds of not just friends, but collaborators and people to tell you when a piece of writing isn't working really made a big difference.
Wow. So yeah, so Jason said to me super excitedly, yeah, Joshua's book is coming out really soon. So I heard an interview with you on Dissent. Is that right?
Yeah, in Dissent Magazine. Yeah,
Dissent Magazine, which was a great, I loved that piece, and we'll make a link to it. Yeah. So I heard a little bit what your dissertation, which is now turned into this book, is about. But do you want to just say a few words about that? I'd love.
Sure.
It sounds fascinating.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So the book is going to be called Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man. It is forthcoming from Harvard University Press. And a lot of what I'm exploring in the book is how African-American authors from the 19th century forward have taken up animal figures in their poetry and fiction as a way to imagine a version of human personhood that is not rooted in dominion or private property, right? So how do we think about the ways in which Blackness makes available to us ways of imagining our relation to non-human forms of life that isn't purely based on dominating them, right? This is Adorno, right? The idea that the only relationship men have with nature is how to use it to dominate it and other men, right? And so I was just trying to think about that a lot, sort of what does the Black radical tradition offer us that's radically different from that? And so I've been writing about that since I was about 22 years old, and now it's going to be a book, so I'm excited.
Who are the authors that you look at?
Yeah. So right now in this present iteration of the book, I'm looking at Richard Wright, Toni Morrison, Zora Neale Hurston, Jesmyn Ward, who, for folks that don't know, check out her work, Men We Reaped, Salvage the Bones, George Jackson, and Lucille Clifton.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so it's good. And it's coming out from Harvard University Press?
Yeah.
Okay, in the fall?
It should be out within the next year or so, the next year or two. I'm working on it. It's an academic book, so I'm just trying to like pull it all together. But yeah, within the next 2 years, it'll be out.
Okay, we're going to jump all around, but I got to go back to Jason, because I brought Jason up not only because he's someone that we have in common and he's extraordinary, but also because Jason is getting married this summer. And nice. He mentioned to me that are you reading? Are you performing?
I'll be reading a new poem at new their poem. Wedding.
Okay. So. Yeah. First of all, this isn't going to air until after Jason is married.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's such an honor to be a part of someone's wedding ceremony.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, certainly not all poets are asked to do that. But I think that sometimes people do turn to the poet in their life if they have a friend who's a poet and ask them to somehow be involved in a wedding ceremony. And so I was wondering if you've done that before or how you're preparing for this, how you're thinking about it, because it's such an interesting role.
Mm. It is, and terrifying in a good way, right? Fills one with awe. I mean, so I read a poem at Rodney's wedding, at our mutual friend Rodney's wedding, and my process for it is historically to sort of interview the folks that are getting married and talk to them so that there are details in the poem that are meaningful for them, but also to just get a sense of like what they're after, what the ceremony means to them. So it's not just sort of a generalized poem, especially if I'm closer to one party than the other. Like, I really want to do my best to incorporate folks' voices and ideas into it as best I can. So I'll probably just do that again with Jason and Mercy. And
do you do that like way in advance or
months in
so
advance?
So have you already done that?
No, but they live across the street from me. So that'll happen within the next, literally.
Yeah.
You walk across the street and that's where they are. So when they just asked me maybe 2 or 3 days ago. So I'm going to set up an interview time and we'll get it done.
Wow, that's super cool. And so, and do you record it or do you take notes? You
record it
audio. Yeah. And then, and do you use like bits of the actual, of their language, or is it kind of inspiration for what you're going to do?
Yeah, sometimes it's actual bits of the language, like phrases, but for me, at least the most recent time where I undertook a project like this, it was more just to have that universe in the back of my mind and have it as a kind of co-conspirator to whatever sort of music was already playing and the vision I had outlined for the poem.
You know, I'm thinking about, so my husband Josh and I just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary 4 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so we rewatched the video of our wedding, which we have a video. We made my oldest son and my youngest son watch. And
okay, his family.
Yeah, there was very. My oldest son was like, "Thanks for having children, but weddings are horrible." He was not into it.
Yeah.
And my youngest son was like, "Why'd you do that? It's so boring." I didn't find it boring.
Yeah.
I found it sort of excruciating.
Yeah.
Because to see how nervous I was.
Yeah.
Jason is an adult, so I don't think he's going to be as nervous as I was. Yeah. I was like so young. But one thing I the rabbi that we had, we didn't really know him super well, but we knew him. We really liked him. And he did a lot of talking to us beforehand, which was lovely. But then in the ceremony, he read one of my poems. And I didn't know he was going to do that. And, you know, I hadn't had a book published or but I must have given him a whole bunch of stuff. Like, he knew I was a poet and that was something I cared about. And it wasn't bad. I don't mean the poem, but like the experience wasn't bad that he included my words in the ceremony. But thinking about it later, I was like, that's kind of interesting to do that. I mean, you're in a really different situation because Jason and Mercy have asked you to do this. And it'll be kind of your words. I think I'm like really interested in this because, I mean, first of all, I think that how do I say this? Like, I've always been really interested in the ways in which in certain academic circles, the idea of an occasional poem or a poem that's specifically written, you know, composed or performed or shared for an occasion is in my experience, in my academic experiences, was kind of demeaned. And yet, like, we all know that there's, you know, the birthday poem, the anniversary poem, the love poem, the, you know, the poem for a wedding, and that the relationship between poetry and specific occasions or specific people or for specific functions is deep, deep.
Ancient.
Yeah. And I think it's in largely kind of what poetry does, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in that. Both because you're like on the cusp of this important moment where you're going to be involved in these people's lives forever.
Wow.
Like, you know, they're going to, whatever poem you write, not to put pressure on
it's
you,
okay.
is going to be part of this incredibly important ritual in which they, you know, undertake this big step. So I'm you know, I'm interested in that. The poem that you wrote and delivered at Rodney's ceremony, does that, what happened to that poem afterwards? Is it in one of your, you know, is it a one-time poem for you or does it continue in your body of work? I guess is what I'm asking.
That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, it hasn't really had an afterlife in print. I mean, it's on my computer and they have it and it's been recorded. So I guess it has its own sort of life there. Like you said, right. In the annals of their life, in the archive of their love. And I think that's what's most exciting for me. I mean, just your point about poetry as either an occasion for gathering or as itself like a touchstone for a given occasion. So I'm working on a special issue of Callaloo on Elegy, right? And I'm thinking about Elegy right now a lot. But also, as you're saying, its relationship to Epithalamion, right? Like the poem that is specifically for the wedding. And those things as these really interesting counterpoints to each other, right? Like both death and life in death and life after death, and also the wedding as the formation of a new life, multiple lives coalescing into something new and altogether unwieldy. And yeah, so I don't know. I think it might go in the next book now that I'm thinking about it. I might have both of these in the next book. I'm working on a new collection right now. But yeah, for me, it's usually just been like, look, this is one of my gifts to you guys. Like, I'm here to do this, to honor you both, to keep this relatively brief, but do my best to bring even more beauty sort of into the room, and to honor the occasion and to honor the fact of your request. I never take it lightly, one, that anyone gathers in a room to hear me read anything, but especially to invite someone to come out and do something like that. That's huge. And to trust me with that stage and that moment.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the position where someone's asked you to suggest a poem to read at a wedding, not one that you've written, not an original poem? Because I often get asked, like, oh, I'm looking for the two requests that I get from people I don't know super well for poems is usually like poems to read at a memorial service and poems to read at a wedding. And I actually have found it really hard to find poems to read at a wedding. And which makes me think about, I never know how to pronounce the word say it again.
I think it's Epithalamion, but I'm not sure.
I think you're right, Epithalamium. Like the form of it, thinking about it, thinking about elegy, thinking about ode, thinking about
I think it's Epithalamium.
Yeah, I'm just gonna call it a marriage poem, but
a marriage poem. I love that. Amp, that works.
Yeah. But like, you know, I think that you know, as we're both sort of saying that there is a long, long, long history of poetry being used for occasions. And yet it's my sense that the poems that were written for Epithalamium.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, now I'm stuck. Epithalamion.
Epithalamion.
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
So like that poems that were written for other people's weddings or for weddings, right? Yeah. So not love poems exactly, because it's a little bit of a different function, because there's a third person who's, right? I don't feel like those have survived in the same number that elegies have or that odes have. And I don't really know why.
Me neither.
Yeah. Time for a new anthology, but seriously, I'm not doing it. Yeah. There are a few, but none of them are fantastic.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm also really interested in how this kind of connects to all of your work, because I feel like I'm really interested in the ways in which you are a scholar, an academic. You're coming out with this book of literary criticism and close reading, I'm assuming. You're a poet and you're also a performance artist. And I feel like maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people were very invested in the argument about performance or slam poetry versus like page poetry or whatever you want to call it. And like, I think that we're done. Well, at least I'm done with that, with that as an argument or with that as like a site of conflict. But we're not done with it as, I think like a way of talking or thinking about like different places that poets come from or different places that poets get their energy.
Yeah.
And I think where was it? I just saw that Patricia Smith was saying that, you know, no matter how many no matter how many awards she's won, no matter how many books she's published, that people still primarily kind of think about you know, they talk about her as a slam poet or as a performance poet. So I feel like, you know, the books of poetry that I've been reading in the past 10 years that are really exciting to me. Many, many of those poets have come from a performance background. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I was hoping we could talk about that too. Like that was first for you. You know, you were writing and performing poems long before The Sobbing School came out.
Yeah.
How'd that start?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it for me started as sort of a little boy in the Baptist church and seeing deacons and ministers and the effect that oral recitation, that a certain vision of the spoken word had on people. People would, you know, fall, cry, do backflips, run. And I remember just as a child feeling that energy and saying, whatever that is, I want it. I want to tap into that. I want to be able to move people in that way. Sort of my mother and a lot of the folks I grew up around that were in that tradition would talk about something that was their word for the week or their word for the month, the idea that there was a part of the sermon that they would keep with them almost as a kind of talisman or something to encourage them, even after they left the space. And so I think my connection to sort of spoken word performance, stage performance comes from that in large part. And then when I was 17 years old at Sarah Lawrence, actually, I went to a Hurricane Katrina relief benefit that was put on by Aja Monet, my friend and colleague. And there was the first time I saw sort of spoken word poetry. It was her, it was Carlos Andres Gomez, it was this incredible group of both sort of teenage Elizabeth Acevedo, like both teenage poets and sort of older folks, who even now, right, like Carlos is getting his MFA, Elizabeth, you know, it's come through University of Maryland for her MFA, and people are really blurring these lines that are so strangely policed to me. I mean, because on the one hand, right, sort of oral poetry is the older tradition in the West, right? Like, if we're thinking about sort of Greek oral recitation, you stand outside and you're giving folks the poem, and if you can't do that well, right, if you can't hang, if you don't have chops as a performer, you don't have an audience, right? And so there's this way in which the idea that literary poetry has no necessary oral component, or that words shouldn't sound beautiful when they're given to the air, has always seemed rather dubious to me, I think even when I was 17, because the poems that I was performing, I wrote them down in my, you know, yellow spiral notebook that I carried with me to school every day. And these were lines that I labored over. I didn't necessarily know what I wanted a line break to do. I didn't know much about enjambment, but this was work that I was wrestling with. And the poems I would perform were not identical to those poems, right? I would improvise often. I still do. You'll never necessarily see me read a poem or enact it in a way that's identical to the words on the page, but that's part of it. Like, that's what makes it come alive in performance. So, yeah, that has meant a lot to me. I mean, Tehinba Jess just won a Pulitzer, right? So I think we're seeing not just, I think, a moment in which people that come from spoken word and performance traditions can be taken seriously within what operates under the umbrella of the literary world, but also where people can understand that it's all poetry and poetics, and that we have a lot of instruments to give each other. I mean, that's really all I'm interested in, is sort of collaboration and conviviality, right? Like, I learned a lot from folks that were not rooted in a spoken word tradition. They taught me a ton about form and how a poem should move, and just put me on to incredible writers that I wasn't really checking for in the same way. And what I hope folks can gain from the performance artists that raised me and trained me up is, one, a certain kind of democratic sensibility, right? In a poetry slam, you have 3 minutes to convince an audience of strangers to be on your side. That is a remarkable skill that can be transferred to a number of different, not just professional avenues, but just circumstances in one's life. And secondly, to read your poem like you like it, like you care about it. You know, it doesn't mean you have to be theatrical, but just be present. And spoken word gave me that presentness as a 17, 18, 19-year-old. And it continues to, I think, feed me in that way even now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but so I did a few slams in New Haven when I was at college at Yale. And I didn't get very far, but I won a little money.
Come on.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was like, you know, I come out of my mother was a storyteller. And so I come out of an oral tradition that I was, you know, dragged around, you know, to hear people tell stories. And it was really like, our version of the church, you know, and Bible stories, and so that really was always there for me, a real strong, like, oral component. an attachment to the human voice, yeah. And to performance, and to a particular kind of performance, because storytelling is not the same as acting,
yeah.
And connection to audience. And so that was always really, that's what I thought. I thought poetry was both very connected to that, although different as well, because I was trying to distinguish myself. You know, I'm a poet. I'm not a storyteller. You know, now I think I'd love to be a storyteller.
Yeah.
I learned really, really quickly in those slams. First of all, certain kinds of content definitely more likely to win you money.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, 1992. To New Haven, you got a blowjob in your poem, you're gonna make it to at least to round two.
Okay,
that's my you know, retroactive advice. What you just said is like a huge deal. Like, read your poem, like you like it, like you care about it, like you're not wasting everybody's time. And I think that's there are poets that I really, really love who are just really shy or not great readers. And then there's a kind of, I think, like style or aesthetic that I really have very little patience for that doesn't, I think, come out of shyness. It comes out of like a sense that I always feel that it's disrespectful to the audience. It's like they're not prepared. They're reading it as if like, you woke them up in the middle of the night and they didn't know you were going to be there. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, just that, I think, you know, all of those, there are so many lessons to be learned, you know, from just getting up in front of people. But I want to come back to what you were saying about instruments, like, and also on some level, I guess I'm curious why, particularly performance poets or spoken word artists who have an audience and who have the excitement and the adrenaline and the community would choose to go get an MFA or would choose to, you know, put a lot of time and energy into publishing a book of poetry. Like, what is it that you get from that experience that you don't have, you know, if you kind of stay more in the spoken word world.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, at least for me, it was a new vista. It was a new adventure. I'm a lifelong learner. I mean, I think part of it too is I was in a PhD program in English around the same time. And I think started to be more interested in what the linkages might be between the spoken word tradition I'd been a part of for a while at that point and the literary theory I was not just reading, but trying to produce. I think for me, literary poetry felt like this really interesting intermediary space that I should explore personally. But I think for other folks, there are all kinds of reasons. I think it's to stay with sort of the metaphor of instruments. It's a way to like sharpen your tools, mm-hmm. I think in one way, right? To learn economy, to read some stuff that maybe you weren't reading before, or maybe you were, but it fills a spoken word toolkit, I think, in a different way to pursue the MFA or to read literary, what people call literary poetry. Because I think it's all interwoven in a way that at least a lot of the folks I came up with understand fundamentally, that we were in elementary school and middle school and we were really just given Frost and Hughes for maybe, right? And those poets are incredible and have won like much wider sort of oeuvres than you'd be led to believe by the syllabi they're feeding kids in public schools and private schools, right? Because I went to a elite private school and we weren't reading much in the way of interesting poetry, I didn't think either. But that's, I think, what turned so many of us on to spoken word in the first place, was that what we were being told was poetry. It was like, well, this is rather drab and has no truck with what I feel when I see someone really get up and kill it on stage. And I think maybe for some of us, that not even so much a return, but that that investment, yeah. Right, in not just like sort of traditional MFA programs, but even for folks like me who are mostly self-taught, is in saying, okay, well, how can I expand my universe and give an audience more? How can I even create a material object, like a book? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of what was so exciting to me, is that once the book came out, I could hand this to my mom. Like, she can show her friends videos, sure. But now my mom can walk into Strand or Barnes & Noble and, like, her son's name is on this thing,
yeah.
You know? And I think so much of it really is that, like, the book as an ancient technology as well, mm-hmm. like, just like the voice that you want to pass on and distribute, so...
Yeah, I mean, I it's so incredible to have both, right? Like, yeah, to have maybe this poem that you're going to write, you know, for Jason and Mercy's wedding that might just exist for that moment, yeah, and that event, and it will exist for them forever, but it will be like, you know, when actors put on a play for two nights and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And to also have the book, which exists for a long, long time, and your mom can have it and strangers can read it, and it doesn't depend on your presence. It doesn't depend, right, you know, on your performance. I mean, I can see really easily what literary poets or page poets, there's no real, you know, whatever, poets who primarily write,
yeah,
on paper.
Yeah, live there. Maybe, yeah, that's right.
I can see what they have to gain and learn from performing their work, and from having a lot more contact with an audience and with a community,
yeah,
and with different kinds of events and like live experiences. What are the things though that you feel like now that you've written that book and now that you've sort of trained also in a kind of, you know, with a form that's intended for the page, does that change your performance work? Like,
yes.
Yeah.
I think it has, because I have to figure out how to play with my voice and body differently to make some of this stuff come alive, reading, yeah, from a book, right? Because I think also, I don't know, I think people expect something very specific when they hear someone's going to be reading from a book of poetry. Mm-hmm. And I really want to upset that, and absolutely upset it, you know, in much the same way that most of my audiences, since I was 17 years old, one of the most common things people say after, it's like, man, I didn't think I liked poetry.
Yeah.
Or they'll even say, I don't like poetry, but I like that.
Yeah.
And if that's poetry, then I'll watch some of your videos at least, right? And then they'll watch some of my friends' videos, and then they're like, oh, I actually like this quite a bit. And so, I don't know. I think I'm just finding new ways back into the reading. I mean, I'm also listening to recordings of Gwendolyn Brooks and Audre Lorde and like folks from throughout the 20th century that were reading.
Yeah.
Often like very what folks would term, you know, experimental work. One in places like churches, like the basements of churches, like for folks that are part of gangs and outside and in libraries, right? They believed that poor folks and black people and brown people were smart and that they deserved a wide range of work that sounded all different kind of ways, right? And I think I believe that. That's my tradition too. Mm-hmm. Those put Jupiter Hammond, Phyllis Wheatley, that's my tradition too. And I think I just claim all of it. It all matters to me. The hip hop stuff, that matters too. That's the lyric poetry of our age, right? Like for me, I think all of that stuff can coexist and needs to, and we can learn a ton from each other. And often now, some of my favorite rappers are also some of my favorite poets on the page. Like the people I came up with in workshops are doing all of those things and doing them incredibly well. And they also write TV now and plays, some of these folks. So it's,
yeah,
kind of cool.
Yeah. I was just, I watched the video of you performing. It's 16 bars for Kendrick Lamar,
yeah.
Which is amazing. And of course, like part of me was like, oh, just do the whole podcast asking Joshua all the questions that he poses to Kendrick. Like,
yeah.
Because one of them was, does this question of lyrics versus history versus aesthetics rest on your mind like a plucky barnacle just taking up space? Yeah, does it?
For me, absolutely.
Yeah, because it seems like, yeah, you could look at you're invested in so many different forms and so many different kind of fields of inquiry around whatever this thing is that we call poetry and writing and art and voice and community and there's a word that's missing there that I think has to do with the church basement. And, you know, I don't know whether it's testifying, it's not,
yeah,
the right word exactly, but
yeah,
you're involved in all of those.
Yeah.
And I imagine in part because it's resting on your mind. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it just stuck to me. I don't know. I mean, Fred talks about this a lot, right? And I think he's riffing on Sam Cooke and a lot of other folks. Where he talks about what sends him. And I think what sends me, that there are a couple of different things that send me, like my love for the music, the world that I feel like literary theory opened for me when I was 18 years old and or 17 rather, and realized I wanted to become a professor from reading Cornel West's Race Matters on the train to school every day. It was like a 2-hour trip, and I would just sit with that book and just go backwards and forwards through it. And I realized I wanted to become a professor. I think teaching Black children and trying to make a world for them sends me like that. That is the work that invigorates me and that I wake up every day to try to do. I'll be running an arts fellowship at Columbia next year called the June Jordan Fellowship. And so much of what I'm trying to do there is really just create workshop space in Harlem and the Bronx for kids to come paint and make music and write plays and write poems and do the stuff that honestly, like, I was penalized for doing when I was 5. I almost got kicked out of school because I was told I was a distraction and couldn't function in a classroom because I was drawing all the time. And I think so much of the work that not only sends me but motivates me politically now is tied to that. Like, this idea that I just didn't know what this stuff was when I was a kid. And I feel like I want people to have access to all of it. The people I grew up with in these various spaces, I think they should have access to all of it. You should have access to Derrida and Mackie and June Jordan. Like, you should have access to these folks to be able to read them and think with them. Because they loved us. Ed Roberson, these people loved us. And they loved us enough to give us complexity and to give their lives to the creation of something else, to the imagination of something else. And so,
who gave you the Cornel West book, or how did you find it? How'd you come to be reading it on the train?
How did I come to find Race Matters? Why have I not thought about that in about 10 years? I mean, I feel like it must have been either a suggestion from someone at church at the time, or it could have even been one of my teachers in high school.
Mm-hmm. You've talked at Sarah Lawrence, and also in interviews, I've seen you talk about the experience of going to Rye Country Day.
Yeah.
But you did talk a little bit about, the real difficulty of being in these very elite, very white, exclusive academic educational institutions, and also the privilege or the opportunities that being in those institutions kind of afforded you. I wonder, from your experience of having gone through a school like Rye Country Day and Princeton, and now you're at Harvard, and where did you go to college?
Went to Penn.
To Penn. Okay, yeah. So you've been in all of these different environments, and I also remember you talking about at Sarah Lawrence this incredibly heartbreaking story of the school that you were in closing and being turned into a parking lot.
Yeah.
And that school being a school, an all-Black school, and with a really long history and an important, you know, institution that then ended. So, okay. So to come around to my question, what could have been done better for students like you for white students to in those very resource rich and often narrow-minded places?
How much time do you have? I mean, there are a lot of issues, at least for me, in the early 2000s. I mean, part of it was I had to travel 2 hours a day to get to school. Now I've heard at Rye Country Day specifically, they bus kids in that are coming from that far. And I think that's huge, especially when you have millions of dollars at your disposal. I think
because you probably weren't going that many miles.
No,
you
were just
You were going from one place to another that people weren't supposed to go to.
So I took 2 buses and a train every day. I woke up at 5:30 a.m. I was in various extracurricular activities. So I would get back to my neighborhood maybe around 9, and then I start several hours of homework, and then you wake up at 5:30 to do it again.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had a counselor tell me when I told her I want to apply to Penn that Black kids from my high school don't go to Penn, so I don't know what to tell you. And she said it and it sounds strange. I'm not apologizing for her in any way. She said it in such a straightforward manner. She was like, no, this is just information. This is data. Like, we don't have any instruments to understand the kind of future you want. So I can't, I'm a counselor for white kids with money. So I can't really help you, but here's a bunch of places you can apply. And best of luck to you, sir. So, I mean, I think a couple of things could be done differently. One, I think sort of active work to recruit and retain black faculty and faculty of color. I think that just would have made a huge difference sort of representationally, especially since the teacher that lobbied for the black students, many of us, I mean, I'm trying to think where all of us went to college. I mean, Shamaka ended up at Harvard, Rodney went to Yale, I went to Penn. And even if that wasn't the case, it still made a huge difference that students that really were performing rather well in the sort of standard English track, we weren't tracked for honors English. Mm-hmm. She lobbied for us to be in AP English, and it changed all of our lives. Now I'm a professor of English, and that is directly tied to my English teacher, you know, from my sophomore year, who was like, no, this kid is really smart. Mm-hmm. And because he's from South Yonkers and not from Rye, not from Harrison, not from Amerenek, you have him tracked to not take the kind of courses he needs to get into the kinds of schools that wealthy white children from this school go to, period. Right. Right? So I think that could have been done differently. I don't know. I mean, the things that were done well, more resources could be poured into it. So we had a guidance counselor that, again, actively checked in with us, with the black and Latino students in particular. She checked in with us to see how we were doing. Are you okay? Come see me. Drop by the office, right? That mental health resources need to be invested in for these kids. Because it's not just that the work is hard. It's that every day something racist happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day. And I'm also trying to do AP English. Like, that is stressful. And I also don't live here, and I don't get invited to any parties. And that kind of sucks because I'm 15, you know, and I'm dealing with all this stuff. So I think that could have been, so mental health resources, faculty, actually trying to create student bodies that remotely reflect the country we live in would also be useful, right? Like, as if there aren't students that are academically talented enough throughout a place like New York State for you to just actively go recruit those students. I don't buy it that these schools have to look this way. I think they can look radically different, not only at the level of race and class representation, but also geographically. Like, you can pull kids from all over in ways that'll make a huge difference. But I think fundamentally it's about rethinking what a school is.
Yeah.
What a school should be, what a school can and should look like. What do places like Rye Country Day or even Friends, what do they owe the surrounding communities, places like Port Chester? Like, you're taking up space in that community. What do you owe maybe those folks the next city over and their children? Mm-hmm. What should you want to give them mm-hmm. with your bounty, right? And that's tough because that's also rethinking the logic of private property. Private school is private for a reason, right? It's supposed to, you know, replicate the ruling class and their desires, their ideologies, their aesthetics, right? And it's designed for one kid like me to get in there. You're not necessarily that threatened by me. I'm just going to be very honest right
yeah.
now. You're not necessarily that threatened by me getting through. And even within that, like, there were various moments where black students were actively, I mean, and told to their face that their grades were being lowered because of their attitudes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of surprise when we exceeded expectations. There's a lot of work that needs to be done for places like Rye to change and to be anything other than sort of just a bastion of white supremacy and class domination.
Yeah. Do you ever imagine wanting to work in an institution like that? Or do you feel like you're going to put your effort and energy into creating other kinds of institutions? Do you ever imagine, you know,
other spaces?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this is what I mean about fundamentally rethinking school. Because part of the Rye Country Day stuff is I am an alumnus. I went there. So, like, I have an investment.
Yeah.
I went back there last year, and there was an incredible student, black girl, senior, stood up and had been leading protests there during the year and, like, asked me about my stance as a black alumnus and, like, taking this school to task, right? Her life is a life. Like, there are students there. There are poor students, not all of whom are non-white, right? Like, there are kids that need support in these spaces, and I'm committed to them because someone was committed to me. Mm-hmm. Someone very easily could have said, well, you go to Rye Country Day. Like, Josh, I needed a ton of help in all kinds of ways that people provided for me. So I think there are ways, one, to support those kids, to put pressure on those institutions to redistribute wealth in ways that'll benefit a broader population of young people, but also to create alternative educational spaces as well. Because I think it's necessary. I mean, it's part of what's so difficult, right? And there are educational theorists, folks like Michael Dumas, who write that like school in the United States is a site of Black suffering, sort of across the board in private and public schools, right? Where kids are getting tackled by cops. I had metal detectors in my middle school. Books didn't have all the pages in them. That really was a site of suffering for me as well, as was my elite private school, as were the Ivy League institutions I attended afterwards, right? So in some ways, there's no way out of it for some of these kids and for some of these human beings, because the systems we have are fundamentally designed to erase and eradicate them, right? So how do you make a kind of life within that? That's what I'm committed to. How do you create alternate spaces? Often trying to leverage what I have, leveraging a doctorate from Princeton so people take me seriously, which is wild, but this is really how these things function, right? It's like, well, all right, if we're gonna listen to someone today, we'll let this guy, you know, pitch a project and we'll let him carry it through. And so part of my desire is to leverage as much of that money as I can, as much of that space, as much of that time toward helping kids get the resources they need to move and survive. And I started this Driver's Row alongside my older sister in 2010, in part because I kept seeing, you know, spoken word artists not really get paid to perform places. We would get invited places and people are like, well, thank you, bye. I'm like, you wanted me to fly out, you know, to Minnesota to do a gig and not get paid. And so I started this collective of my friends and people I knew, and we started an agency and we toured the world. You know, and folks went all kind of places, India, Botswana, we toured together in the UK, and I'm proud of that. That's one of my proudest achievements. I started an all-Black performance collective, and we had our set fees, and we did our thing for many years.
Who do you represent?
Yeah. Well, now we don't do it anymore because we're all like married and have jobs, but there were great folks in it. They're all in the book, and the acknowledgments with Zora Howard, Alicia Harris, Carmen Sassant, Miles Hodges. And me, and we would tour, and it was amazing.
And no one else wanted to keep it going?
I said everybody got married, like that's all that happened. But I think
that was the end of everything.
Yeah, everyone was like, yo, look, man, I'm out. No, I think only one of us even got married. I feel bad. I think part of what happened is that a lot of us were in graduate school at the time, but also got very intensely involved in that. I think people wanted to pursue other creative projects and not just tour as a group. And I think people started to pursue other genres in ways that were important. Like Carve is an actor now. He's signed to an agency doing like film and TV stuff and Broadway stuff. And that's like his life. I think Miles started working at the New York Public Library and building that out. Zora went to get her MFA in San Diego. Alicia moved to Atlanta, I think has a home in Atlanta now. And I decided I wanted to be an academic full time, which made it difficult to tour and create content in the ways I wanted. And I also think it's fine for things to sort of run their course, right? I mean, I think part of what I'm so proud of with this Driver's Row is I think we at least tried to create a space, not just in the, you know, the ever-present marketplace, but also hopefully in people's lives where they got to gather, right? Again, we come back to gathering and testimony and testifying. And we had parties, you know, after every show. And we packed out a venue with 1,200 people. We packed out Stage 48 for poems, you know? And I have that for the rest of my life. We all have that we were part of that beautiful thing. That we were Black people daring to assert that we were alive and our voices mattered and our lives had value. And so, I don't know. I'm just trying to do a little bit of that every year. Like every year I'm alive, I'm trying to just create something or pour into something that has meaning for folks.
Tell me about the June Jordan School. And then let's read a poem.
For sure. So the June Jordan Fellowship will be hosted at Columbia University this year through the Center for Justice over there. Okay. It started as a grant from the William R. Keenan Charitable Trust, who approached me last year about investing in arts programming in New York City. So I wrote the proposal, and it's an idea I've had in my mind for a while. Like, what would it mean to just bring incredibly gifted teaching artists to one place for a year, provide them with stipends, and have them teach a workshop that is free and is open to the public and is specifically catered toward teenagers in Harlem and the Bronx. And so we're doing that now. We selected our finalists. We'll be announcing our inaugural cohort in the coming days. And we'll also be building out a sort of June Jordan teaching corps. So even outside of our sort of 3 to 5 fellows we bring every year, we'll also have teaching artists that are based in the city that are putting on sort of master classes for folks in photography and playwriting. And they'll also get paid, and it'll be nice.
Awesome. So the finalists are the teaching fellows.
Yeah, are sort of the 3 to 5 primary teaching fellows. Yeah,
got it. And that'll be a full time for them, full time work, or like
So they get stipends of $26,000. They'll be visiting scholars at Columbia, have full library access. They can take whatever courses they want at Columbia, and Yeah, they represent the program.
And who are the students?
The students are from all over. So right now we're trying to do outreach to like local schools and community centers to get the folks that'll be in the workshops. That'll be around 15 to 20 people each. That'd be amazing if we were able to fill all of those. But also even above and beyond that, the teaching core will be opening up other workshop spaces.
And are the workshops continuing? Like, will you go into a school and have like a long-term relationship with them? Or are they like, you come in, you do kind of like what you did at the Day of Concern at Friends? Like, is it which model, you know?
Yeah. So they won't be in specific schools, but we're reaching out to schools to sort of suggest students and have students apply for these workshops that will then be held in like community spaces in Harlem and the Bronx.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm just so curious about the logistics of it because I feel like the logistics actually are super important.
Yes. Renting out spaces, workshop spaces and theater spaces. So now that we have the finalists and we're selecting the cohort, we know what kinds of spaces we have to book, like black box theater. Some are just classrooms. Some will actually be on Columbia's campus, which is also really important to me because Columbia's in Harlem. And it meant a lot to me to try to find a way to have those particular young people taking up space on Columbia's campus, because Columbia takes up a ton of space in their community.
Yeah.
So some of the workshops will be held on Columbia's campus proper, but also in Harlem and further uptown.
And is there an age?
So mostly between 13 and 18.
13 and 18. And then is it like semester long or how long?
So the workshops will be semester long workshops. So that can be held in either the fall and the spring. That will be up to the individual fellows that we're bringing in.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited. We had about 200 applications in our first year, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And just a very wide range of dancers and filmmakers, playwrights, poets, really incredible folks whose work I love. And it was a great honor to pour over the applications. We had a lot more than we expected, so the process took a long time to sort of go through each individual application and then to think about. And I'm sure you've done like selection in this vein. Like, you have to think about a cohort then, right? Like, okay, so we have these people, so many folks with tremendous work, but how do we, one, have a balanced program in terms of what we're offering, and how might these folks work together to create what we're trying to create?
And tell me it's not just going to be 1 year.
No, it's continuing. The goal is to continue to renew this after this year and we get all our data together to see impact and all that good stuff.
Okay.
For Kenan, but also hopefully find some outside funders. So if you know anyone that wants to donate a lot of money to help kids learn and grow.
Yeah.
Hit me up.
Okay. Did you hear that, everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. Seriously, what's it called?
Yeah, it's called the June Jordan. You can Google the June Jordan Fellowship.
Okay.
It's at the Center for Justice at Columbia University.
Fabulous. And people can donate directly to that. They don't have to donate to Columbia.
To the program. Just reach out to me and then we'll set it up with the trust. That'd be great. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So I don't remember who sent me your book, but I got your book.
Uh-huh.
I read it.
Oh, we got to talk about the book. Right. Okay.
And then I met you at Sarah Lawrence and I heard you read with Araceli Scarmai.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best readings I've ever heard.
Thank you.
And then I reread your book and reached out to you. You must have thought I was completely wacko because I went up to you and like almost burst into tears because I had the experience of sitting behind your mother, your father, and your brother. And I was having a tough time with one of my teenage boys. Mm. And so I was watching, I was sitting behind your mother watching you read.
Yeah.
And the experience was like very profound.
Hmm.
Because first of all, you were amazing, but also imagining just one like subtle hue of what it could have felt like for your mother to watch you know, not knowing your mother. But hearing you read these poems about your family and about your childhood and about your life, and knowing that I was sitting right behind your mother, there was something like, you know, and sitting there and thinking about my son and worrying about him and you know, anyway, so I came up after the reading and tried to like tell you all of that, which was a bit inappropriate perhaps, but very much like me.
Of course. Yeah. No. That was beautiful.
So I don't know. You've got four books with you.
Yeah. Well, these are like just books that help me organize my ideas.
Yeah. So you've got your book, which is The Sobbing School, mm-hmm. which is amazing. I also have a copy of it right here. Nice. But first, before you read a poem, tell everybody what are the other three books you brought and why those.
Yeah. So I have Patricia Smith's Incendiary Art because it's incredible. I think a lot about, it's so interesting given the conversation we've had already just about, my trajectory as a writer has been so influenced by Patricia Smith, not just because she was one of the first folks that I felt like gave me permission to use all of the language I had available to me, all the traditions, all the music, that I could bring all of it to bear on the page. I think Patricia Smith taught me that. But she's also just been an incredible mentor and colleague over the past couple of years, and I'm deeply thankful to her and to her entire body of work. Before I submitted my book to the National Poetry Series, I used to carry around Tea House of the Almighty with me when I'll go do gigs and fly places. And so part of the reason I even submitted for that was because of her.
And wait, and how did you come into contact with her?
How did I meet Patricia Smith? I think we met at AWP maybe 2 years ago. And she just knows like a bunch of the same people. And I knew our work from YouTube, of course, reading it.
Pull that mic a little closer to you.
Sorry. Yeah. No, and I just knew her work through YouTube and also just reading online. And so... Yeah, and then we met at AWP 1 year, and then we've read together since. We read together at NYU for a Cave Canem reading. Mm-hmm. And also I was reading at Columbia maybe a year ago at an event that was honoring Patricia Smith. And that was the first time I told her all the stuff I just told you. And she was like, we should hang out, which is nice. Yeah. We got to hang out at the reading. So
nice.
That was good. Then I'm reading Critique of Black Reason by Sheila Mbembe, which is kind of incredible work of criticism that I'm still working through and thinking through. And then Civil War's Book of Essays by June Jordan that I would suggest everyone read because it's helping me even realign what I desire from the university in particular. Like she's writing about a certain protest moment organized by sort of Black and Puerto Rican students in particular at colleges here in New York City. Their demands around Black studies I think have been very useful. I'm helping edit, we can maybe keep this in here. It's kind of a secret. But I'm helping edit right now a sort of anthology of essays about the 50th anniversary of Black Studies, which is coming up in 2018. And so I've been thinking a lot about what it means to have inherited this field, to have lived an entire life in which Black Studies was a thing, because it just wasn't before that.
What was the birth of Black Studies? When was it born?
Yeah. In 1968.
When was it born officially? Black Studies always existed, of course, but...
But even that's kind of a radical claim, right?
Yeah.
That it's always existed, that people gathering, in ships, in the belly of ships, people gathering on plantations, people gathering at parties. My parents met, in a club, and that's a kind of Black Studies or, what Fred Moen and Stefano Harney call Black Study, right? Like those are moments. But in terms of at the institutional level, it's 1968 forward that we see the proliferation of Black Studies programs at universities and colleges throughout the United States.
And what was the first one, or who was the proponent of the?
Yeah. So it starts on the West Coast, in San Francisco State, in the late 60s, and then it moves forward from there. And you see the first flagship PhD programs at Temple, and I think Yale University's AFAM program is the second. They have a joint PhD program where you get a PhD in AFAM and another discipline. And then from there, you see the growth of the field largely through student protests on campuses. Cornell, they're very famous images of students holding guns at Cornell University, sort of protesting for African American studies as well in this time period. And so it's kind of incredible to see the growth and shift.
But you wanted to do a PhD in English, not in African American studies. Was that ever a question for you, or you always knew that that's?
It's a great question. I mean, I applied to an African American studies program, did not get in. So out of the programs I got into, I think, were they all English? No, I got into an American studies program and two English programs. But my training is in African American literature and Black studies. I mean, I claim, like if you go to the Harvard Society of Fellows website, I list Black studies as my discipline, not like English or comp lit, because that's how I understand myself as a scholar. I understand Black studies as a kind of meta discipline that organizes my thinking, not just as a literary theorist, but as a poet. Like that for me is all part of my academic, not just training, but what I want my academic work to be and look like and even sound like. And it's part of why my first book is a book of essays. Like, it's a traditional academic monograph in some ways, but not in others. Like, it's organized like a medieval bestiary where it's like rat, cock, mule, dog, panther, you know, and that's how the book is arranged. And pig is in there too. I'm working on the pig chapter now, about sort of police power, and pig is a vernacular term. Black studies is my life. Black study is my life, and creating spaces where it can flourish.
Do you want, I think I just asked you this question. Uh-huh. So I'm asking you the same question.
Yeah.
Do you imagine moving forward that it's going to be more interesting or important to you to create a new space or to infiltrate and subvert and change an established institutions?
For sure. At both.
Yeah.
Always both and, right? It's what we learn, not just from postmodernism, but just life itself, right? Like, for me, it is both about maintaining a relationship to universities where we can create spaces for people who are not supposed to be there to not just be there, but to steal, you know, to like steal resources, steal knowledge, steal space, and give it back, and proliferate it and just hand it out, you know? So creating those community spaces using university funds and university space is important to me. But then also, the creation of alternate spaces, that are not even necessarily schools as such, but just are places where people gather to learn and love one another and share information, but also have fun and enjoy oneself and maybe like recreate. I don't know. just kind of hang out, because I think that's important too. And I think it's super undervalued, especially in a neoliberal moment where everything has to have a financial aspect to it. Everything is sort of branded and needs to be accounted for in terms of the market and the marketplace and market time. I'm interested in how we can, especially for young people, get them outside of market time and thinking about themselves always already as a kind of personal brand that's accountable for what they can produce in an internet sphere otherwise. So I want space for play.
Which is part of what's great about poetry, because it doesn't really, you know, we complain that you can't make money as a poet, but one of the great things about poetry is it just doesn't conform to the market, which is, you know, so then you have to ask yourself, well, why am I doing this? Because it's not for money. And I think that's one of the things that I think is important about it, or podcasts, you know?
Yeah.
To make spaces that are non-hierarchical and non-capitalist. I mean, we're always within
the
capitalist space, but somehow to I don't know, to play and hang out.
And also to push against the corporatization of these forums, right? Because you're making me think too about the MFA and like people that go into debt to get like poetry degrees, and like people that want to find a way to use poetry and poetics to feed themselves, which I think can be an altogether different enterprise. Because I think too, I mean, I went to Penn, right? Like, the Wharton School is in many ways like the sort of shining light of that institution. And I think my colleagues are always excited in a real way about the fact that I've made a living as a poet. And for me, part of what I'm trying to get, again, especially for young folks, is the idea that the toolkit you get from being a poet, you can take into a range of spaces. Like, I think we all need to be able to eat, and like, I just want you to trust me. Like, the tools you get here in this workshop, I think you will be able to, bare minimum, be able to flip it to survive, to survive in here. Like, not just survive in the material, but this stuff will give you maybe a language you didn't have before, a critical vocabulary, right? To describe what you're feeling. Because my students know what sexism is, what racism is, what queerphobia is, because they live it. But I think having a language for it helps you to not feel alone, right? That's Baldwin, right? You think you're alone and then you read. Mm-hmm. So I hope we can do that too. Because there definitely is a way that like our language, our poetry, the market, and the people that control market forces, they want to find a way to make that something else. They want to bend it. You know, so a lot of our greatest poets, I think, went into advertising and did that. I mean, I guess that's fine. Like, do what you got to do. But also, I'm interested in that. I think our great wordsmiths, a lot of them, we're having our work turned toward certain ends that we should be critical of. So,
yeah.
And I'm included in that.
Yeah, no, I'm included in that too. I mean, I make money at a university, at NYU, which is a hugely problematic organization. And I feel so grateful For that job. And yeah. I also feel grateful for the space that it affords my graduate students to have yes. time to write and to have funding to do that. And I also know that if you just scratch the surface even very lightly about where that money comes from, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's complicated,
yeah.
you know. Okay, let's read a poem.
Besides watching.
Yeah, read something recently.
Let's do it. I might read a Sistina. Awesome. That I don't think I've ever read it aloud. Metal poem. Is how Baraka described John Chikai's deploying the horn like a kind of war machine before either man's lungs were left empty as a shipwreck, body still, stoic as stone and buried deep. Mainstream pop had not yet given John his proper shine, and so I sometimes like to think of the phrase as a chamber with no flash or flame to kill the dim, so black it's blank, the lead off to some broader claim about what touch compels or unmakes. Any leaderless man will cut holes in the world if you let him breathe, I think. Every horn holds a history of violence. Animals slain for the sake of sound, chamber music born of plundered bone. My entire block is metal poem. Endless empty school desks mourned by shoes hung from telephone wire, so high they catch the shine of dawn before anything living. And the beat goes on. Staccato pop of steel, a call to pray. Blood-stained denouement. Pop hears the family car backfire and dreams of Vietnam. Lead spray autographing his left side from boot to hip. Sundays, he loved to shine our shoes and skin until both glowed like opal. Sharp as a hornbill's kiss, my daddy was, before the weight of an empty ledger winnowed him, left his chest hollow as the chamber of a gun in the hands of a man six bodies deep into his rage, every chamber of his tome-thick heart falling slack. The day it all went dark, Pop barely spoke for more than a few clicks of the clock's one good hand. Empty quiet, where once was laughter so full, we felt when it fell to the floor. Who will lead or love us now, the people thought, when Moses melted that metal god from horn to hoof, made them drink. For weeks, their insides shine with the light of the fallen. Little Nove, little faiths aflame. Oh, how I wished to shine the way Pop did when it came time for penance. My mother's stare, a chamber of horrors, pulling names from him till they lie like fresh kill on our kitchen table, hornets filling corpses with chatter. Every morning, the same perverse Pop quiz. Where have you been? He responds as any weapon might. Leaden expression to quell her pursuit, either hand empty, apart from the car keys he will use to open the air between us again, empty out our unearned dreams. His love for the idea of us never fails to shine through. But for how long can you ask a man to lead a life he never yearned for? Silence each chamber clicking inside of him, coaxing both feet forward, demanding he pop his son in the mouth for calling him phantom, when he means to say, my heart is a horn in a hole in the earth, is an empty cell cleansed of sunshine, is a dead man's chamber, nothing worth dying for inside of it, is a lead balloon, is a prop gun in a time of war, is a single splintered thorn. Right. So the next poem is
Is that in your new? Is that in the new
manuscript?
Yeah,
that's in the forthcoming collection.
Do you know what it's called yet?
The new collection.
Yeah.
I have an idea.
Okay.
We might edit this out. Well, I don't know. Y'all see. You'll see.
Okay. Okay.
You'll see soon.
Okay.
I'll read maybe two more. I want to kind of. Well, this is on theme. Praise song for the table in the cafeteria where all the black boys sat together during A Block, laughing too loudly. What is this non-power at the heart of power? Jacques Derrida. Thomas was a riot, by which I mean funny to the point you thought he practiced the same set of jokes on the bus each morning with the sole intention of ruining AP bio, but also as a gesture toward the chaos he brought with him when he entered the room, what its presence stole free in us. When he walked by, white girls would flicker their eyes at him like golden apertures, as if they were trying to copyright his splendor or keep his swagger as an exhibit in a museum. Quiet as it's kept, The combination of me and Thomas and Jeremy and Devin and Eddie was the most color our school had ever let through its doors in a single year. Our collective body, both a kind of shame and a pretty sweet school record all by itself. All we had was A Block's release. Thomas clowning everyone's clearance rack running shoes and lack of game, Devin's impromptu raps, Eddie's impressions, and Jeremy, silent as a marble, speaking only when he had a gem of a dagger to drop, like a dead bird in the desert, like the day he called Thomas a corny-ass rich boy, and how from then on I could think of nothing but the force of the slur as it sailed across our plates, how selfish it was of Jeremy to kill the vibe that way. I mean, really. What's a biography worth if your boys won't let it stretch? Who in their right mind would want us, our threadbare lives, without a little legend to sweeten the frame? What mattered the miles between the hood, its protean borders, and our actual homes, or the first times that never happened, or the nicknames no one called us in real life, when such warm fiction was shared among this huddle of strangers made lifelong friends by a Scantron's omniscience, by our careful parents, and their justifiable fear of the world. Two more.
Okay, is there any chance I could ask you to read Still Life with Little Brother?
Of course.
Okay. And I want to ask you one question about it.
Okay.
It's a big question, but...
It's a big question.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But you can say no also to me.
I know.
Okay.
I love this poem, and I never read it. Okay. Still Life with Little Brother. Every time I attempt what I'm attempting right now, it ends up as some sad lyric about diagnosis, and that sounds like the one kind of violence I don't have a pretty name for. In advance, I don't know if this poem will bring the problem on stage and then pretend it went away to college. I don't know if there is any way around the problem itself, which is that I can only call something love if it comes packaged in language I can feel the weight of, and my brother doesn't always look at me when I visit the house. Sometimes he walks in and sits on the couch and watches TV while I'm watching TV, and our shared there-ness is a prize. Sometimes he asks about me when I'm gone, and no one else ever does that. Levi is my brother's name, and I wrote a poem about him once, and it wasn't about him as much as how fear stalks me like an inheritance, how I fear for him with all of my love, how I know the world like I know the names of famous poets, and the world has claws, Levi. When you were born, I ran back and forth across Auntie's apartment until the floorboards complained, and I am still like that. I am still more proud than I am brave, and you are still the great joy of our rugged hometown, an outlaw all the same. Please, excuse my shadow. I can't stop leaving. I don't know how to name what I don't know well enough to render in a single sitting. Every poem about us seems an impossible labor, like forgetting the face of the sea, or trying to find a more perfect name for water.
So here's my question about that. It's a big one, mm-hmm. but we didn't really get into this, but because I also write about my family, you know, and about friends and my husband and all that stuff. I'm really interested in this question of how each poet makes rules for himself or herself about what they'll write about, what they won't write about, what they'll name, what they, you know, who they'll name. And especially about, how to navigate the balance between writing about the most important things in your life, because to not write about someone or something is to exclude or to ignore or to, you know, erase, and that's not what we want to do. On so many different levels, personal and social and political. But also, how do you tell your own story when it starts to overlap with someone else's story, especially if that person can't necessarily give consent? And so I love the way this poem is so full of love, and also, in, you know, in your own words, like, brings this problem on stage. It's a complex dance, I think, with all poems. It's just, you know, of love, exposure, harm, usury, respect, and you know, and connection. But I think in some poems it's more obvious than in others. So I don't know, you know, how do you think about that? Like either with this poem or yeah. I'm also thinking about the poem that you read at the White House, about your sister Tamara.
Yeah.
How does that work for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think about it a lot, and I guess I just try to find ways to always sort of implicate myself in the writing and in the relationship, and also to the best of my ability, like incorporate those living people sort of in conversations or about the work that's being produced, talking to my parents about the book. They saw the poems in it before it came out, and changing names at places and not other places in the book as well, sort of based on conversations I had with
because
people.
Other people asked you to, or
yeah,
because,
yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. because other people asked me to, and for that I was like, okay, that's really important. I think again it's a complex dance because you're a writer and this is the material of your life, but you also care about folks, you know, and if it's their real names and their real experiences, I think I'm just going to speak from my perspective, because I think also, which is always sort of a dangerous way to lead off into the next thing you say, but I think because I also honor people who say, look, like my dad's alive and he was terrible to me and I don't care how he feels about how he's in the book, how he's in the film, how he's in the song. I dig that too. I think for me, my investment in that is not just that I still live near these people and care about them and talk to them, but I don't... And I also have appeared in people's work in ways that wasn't always flattering.
Yeah.
Sometimes I was in the room. I've had people perform poems that I'm in and like kind of take me to task, you know, in ways that felt deeply hurtful. But I also understand that that's part of being in the complex, messy web of our entanglement, our human relations. So I think about it in a bunch of different ways every day. And I try to do my best to have an ethical relationship to the people that appear in my work, because they're real people.
Is there any difference for you in terms of these questions about a poem that you publish in a book or a poem you perform?
It's the same question. Same for question. Me. Yeah. I'm always thinking about, okay, so I'm incorporating this person into my work. How do they appear? And how do I think rigorously about what I'm trying to even do with this poem, right? Mm-hmm. Like for me, that Kendrick Lamar poem is about a deep love for his work, but also about his resonances with the tradition. So there's like the Gwendolyn Brooks illusion kind of stuff in there. And for me, I recognize that's a real living person who's like my age in the world. And yeah. For me, that's a poem of affirmation and admiration and deep love, right? For who he is and what he's doing. And so I think it's a little different with celebrity than with family, but again, I'm always trying to think, how do these real people appear? Please.
I was just going to say that, you know, when you said it's a poem of affirmation, I realized that I don't think I've really seen you write about, well, you have a few poems that maybe your dad might have been like, I'm not sure about that. Because I was about to say, all of your poems about your family or about named people to me seem like affirmations rather than invectives or, you know. But they're complicated.
Yeah.
You know, so, and other people don't always, what one person's affirmation is another person's
Come
embarrassment.
On. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. Some people are like, I don't want to be in no book anywhere at all.
Right.
Because even if you change my name, someone can still know who I am. And
Have you ever had someone say to you, I you know, don't write about this or I feel uncomfortable, you know, being close to you because I know you're going to put it in a poem.
In a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had those individual conversations with people like, don't put me in a poem.
Yeah.
And I've had conversations with my mother where she's like, we're talking about family stuff. And she's like, don't put this in a book, Josh. And I'm like, come on. Like, I feel like, I don't know. Yeah. I tried to have my family appear here in ways that not just felt true, but felt good, in ways that I felt like I could stand behind and didn't. I mean, frankly, like dishonor them in some ancient sense. Like I didn't want to bring dishonor on my family name, on my household. And so, but yeah, it's tough. It's always a tightrope walk.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Wait, one last thing.
Please.
So when your mom says, don't put that in a poem, and you just made that expression, you were like, come on, but wait, what does that mean? Does that mean I have better sense than that? I wouldn't do that. Or does it mean you got to trust me? If I do put it in a poem, it's going to be okay.
Yes.
Or,
And maybe not okay, but I'm never trying to slander people in my family. Like I love and care for you all. And it's also tough because I'm like, this is also our lives. And other people in my family who are writers have struggled with this sort of interpersonal conflict. People who have written memoirs, for instance, right? And folks in the family appear in it. And it's like, I don't know why you're putting my business on Front Street like that. And have it be real life conflict over that stuff. And I get that too. And I think you work it out. Either in person or My family is big on that. You work it out in person. It's like, you wrote this about me, I'm going to see you about it. Or I heard you wrote this about me, and so you have to see me. And I think that's real too. Because I it's the art. And you raised me to be a writer. You can't have put me through school and told me to invest in myself and in spelling bees. And, you know, you affirmed my life. And now I'm trying to really do that, to be creative. And I'm always going to do it with love, you know. Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You read.
Yeah.
Go okay, for it. Like okay. Awesome. Awesome.
We can go. So this one is actually online, but there's no read. There's no audio of me anywhere doing this poem.
So, I love it.
Yeah. So it's this
a commonplace exclusive.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. And so was Metal Poem. There was no
Metal audio Poem is amazing.
Thank you. I always feel weird reading it. It feels so long, but I like that poem a lot. Yeah. That'll be in the new book. And it was in American Poetry Review, but only in the print copy. So it's for the homies. There's one more poem. And this is, my older sister is in here too, because she's the best. This is Token Sings the Blues. You always are almost always only one in the room. Maybe two. Three is a crowd. Three is a gang. Three is a company of thieves. Three is, wow, there's so many of you. Three will get you confused with people that look nothing like you. You get called Devin. Your name isn't Devin. You do your best not to ignore such casual erasure. You know silence will be received as affirmation, praise even, and you always affirmative. You affirmative action, action figure. You fantastic first black friend. You first ballot quota keeper. You almost cry when your history professor says, you know, in this country, the gold standard used to be people. Funny how no one comes right out and says things like you people anymore. It's all code words like thug or diversity hire. You diversity all by yourself. You contain multitudes and are yet contained. Everywhere you go, confined, like there is always someone watching you, and isn't there, and isn't that the entire point of this flesh you inherited, this unrepentant stain? Be twice as good, Mama says, as if what they have is worth your panic, worth measuring your very life against, and you always remember to measure your hair, your volume, your tone over email, you perpetually sorry. You don't know why. You apologize to no one in particular, just for being around and in your body at the same time. You know your body is the real problem. You monster. You beast of burden. You beast and burden. You horse but human. You centaur. You map the stars and pull back your bow to shoot the moon, and it's one good white eye. You are everything, your big sister says. And on your best days above ground, you believe her.
Thank you. That was incredible. Thank you so much.
Thanks. This was amazing. I had a great time.
This has been episode 34 of Commonplace, Conversations with Poets and Other People. I'm Rachel Zucker. Music by Moses Zucker-Gorin, design work by Eitan Darwish. Commonplace producers are Nicholas Fuenzalida, Christine LaRusso, and Zach Tackett. Our advisor in all things is Daniel Schiffman. Thank you to Duke University Press and to Penguin Books for supporting our raffle, and to all the patrons and the publishers that help keep Commonplace going. Thank you for listening.